Have Florida's political parties come unraveled before next year's election? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Sex scandals and harassment settlements. Political careers in Florida have ended, and some are on the brink of implosion. And that's just in the past few months. We'll look at the fallout from the recent sexual harassment cases in Tallahassee. How will this impact the parties before the upcoming legislative session? And we'll look into the recent news that state taxpayers are on the hook for millions of dollars in harassment settlements. Also, Carlos Alvarez was the first Cuban-born football player at the University of Florida. He was known as the Cuban Comet. He shares with us his story of growing up in Miami in the 60s and playing a sport that Cubans back then never embraced. That's all coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, the Associated Press reported last night that over the last 30 years, the state of Florida has spent $11 million to settle sexual harassment claims. The agencies involved range from the Florida Department of Corrections to state universities. We're going to talk about this and more with Matt Dixon of Politico Florida. He and his colleagues have broken a number of stories in recent weeks about sexual harassment problems in the state capitol. Matt Dixon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so what about this $11 million? What do we know about these cases?
We don't know a ton yet. The records in a very broad format just came out yesterday, as you'd mentioned. The Associated Press had requested them, and we're starting to go through them and get documents and things like that. But what we do know from a broad level is that there was, like you'd mentioned, $11 million tied to sexual harassment lawsuits over roughly a 30-year span. And the biggest focus of those is the Florida Department of Corrections, which has a lot of inmates and some issues that aren't faced necessarily by other departments or agencies. So I don't know that was terribly surprising, but that is by far the biggest, the Department of Corrections, and a lot of that is some inmate issues.
Did anything else surprise you about which state departments or agencies also had a lot of claims?
I would say not yet, but the caveat being, hold that thought. There's a lot of information and a lot of sort of documents and data to go over a 30-year span, and we've only had it since us personally, that I'll do credit to the Associated Press, we've only had it since about 4 or 5 o'clock last night. So I can't point to anything super surprising yet, but I certainly wouldn't be shocked if, something were to come out of it that is even more newsworthy than the, 10,000-foot look.
And from the preliminary view of that report, what about state universities? Do we know if those claims are from students, employees?
We don't yet. There are definitely state universities included. There's along with all of the departments and agencies which are under the governor's administration or the executive branch. So they are included in there, but the information kind of came out in spreadsheet form. So I hate to be so vague because I know this information is stuff that people care about, but we kind of have to go and get the court documents now and go and get some things that can provide a little meat to the initial numbers we have, because right now they're just spreadsheets and we're, trying to expand on that reporting.
And all of this is on the taxpayer.
Yep. That is correct. These are state paid settlements. And the one thing I would point out, it's important that these expand 30 years. So it's different members of the legislature, different governors. There isn't one person you can kind of pin this on necessarily. But yes, the one underlying principle of all this is they are taxpayer-funded settlements.
In the last few months, a number of very prominent state legislators have stepped down or come under attack over allegations of sexual harassment and improper relationships, prompted in a number of cases by reporting by you and your colleagues at Politico Florida. Can you briefly remind us of which legislators?
Well, there's two that we've written about so far. One is a Palm Beach County state senator named Jeff Clemens, who is the sort of the incoming Democratic leader in the Senate. If he would have stayed around, he would have been the top Democrat in the state Senate next year. He ended up resigning the day after we wrote our story about him having an affair with a lobbyist. He stepped aside to kind of focus on his family. And in another story we've written about a kind of a more prominent member, this one of the Republican former Senate budget chief, basically the guy who wrote the Senate's budget, a guy named Jack Latvala from Pinellas County. We've done did a story about a number of women coming forward and with harassment allegations against him. He has remained in the Senate, and he has also kept going his gubernatorial campaign. Senator Latvala is also running for governor, but he's currently under two different investigations, one through the Senate and another through a kind of an outside prosecutor or an independent investigator.
You know, Matt, we've seen in the U.S. Congress scandals recently over secret payments to settle sexual harassment claims. Has this come up in Tallahassee at all?
It has not, in the sense that we saw all the payments yesterday. So I don't know. The payment information that we got yesterday certainly wasn't well publicized or out there, and the state wasn't talking about it. But I don't know if you can call it secret because it was a matter of public record. It came out as soon as media organizations started asking about it. So I guess in this term, secret might be a bit of a subjective term. If you think the state should have been more proactively transparent about it, then it seems secret. But it was ultimately of public record. So if you agree with the payments or not, you can at least see them. They were not the state didn't try to shield them when media organizations requested them.
You know, you think about all this national attention on the issue of sexual harassment, and I've wondered, what has that done to the day-to-day business, the way business is handled, I should say, in Tallahassee? I mean, are politicians and office workers acting differently, walking around, maybe like on eggshells?
Yeah, well, there's sort of a running joke up here that there's, women staffers, women in the process are getting a lot more handshakes than they used to, which I think is probably a good thing. And the state itself, or the state of play up here, kind of in a 4 or 5 block radius around the Capitol, which is where a lot of lobbying organizations, associations, and sort of lawmakers live. It's sort of the ecosystem of the state legislature definitely has a different feel to it. There are people walking around, going out less. There's noticeably less nightlife when the lawmakers are in town, and I think we'll really get a better sense of it come January. And January is the formal start of the legislative session, when all the lawmakers are up in Tallahassee for 2 months, writing the laws and the state budget and doing the people's business. So that's a much busier time here, and I think we'll be able to get a full accounting of what sort of kind of cultural impact it has had here once that begins in January.
Do you get the sense, though, that Tallahassee is trying to put a stop to this problem, this pervasive problem that's been going on for years?
Well, they're trying to do it now because they've gotten caught, I guess I would say. There's a lot of these issues have been sort of simmering under the surface for quite some time. The idea that this is an issue in Tallahassee isn't a new thing. There just sort of seems to be this moment in time after some of the national Weinstein issues where people are more willing to talk about it. There have been women who have wanted to come forward in larger numbers than they have in the past. So right now it is the legislature in Tallahassee at large is kind of reacting to it. But it's more because it's become an issue, not necessarily to prevent the issue, I would say, is how the reaction has been here thus far.
I'm talking with Matt Dixon of Politico Florida. And again, we're talking about some of the fallout from all these sexual harassment stories that have been flying around, not just on a national level, but also here in the state of Florida and, of course, in Tallahassee. And what is that going to mean for lawmakers as they go into the legislative session? Also, next year is an election. You know what we talk about, Matt? We talk about it is a busy time in the Capitol as we get ready for this upcoming session, which is in January. Is a lot of work getting done, though, right now?
Well, there's what every year what are called committee weeks, and essentially those are week-long work periods where meetings are held, legislation is considered, and they kind of feel like a legislative session, but it's not quite as busy. The bigger priorities and the bigger fights haven't really sort of materialized yet. So there has been work over since these stories broke. I think the lawmakers have been back in Tallahassee twice. But the real heavy lift will sort of begin in January, and I think that'll be a better sense when everyone has to come to Tallahassee who's involved in this process. And once everyone's in town, I think you'll get a better accounting of, things like, if less people are going to bars and restaurants, if even people are just, being quieter and acting differently when they're out and about, those sort of things I don't know that I have a full handle on yet, and I think we'll get a better sense of that next month.
Let's take a look
in January.
Okay. Let's take a look at another story that broke just recently with the Democratic Party. The head of the state Democratic Party resigned. Remind us what happened there.
Yeah, he's not an elected official, but sex scandal abounds here in Florida. Florida Democratic Chairman Steve Mattel, some of my Politico colleagues wrote a story about several women coming forward and alleging sort of inappropriate verbal conduct and essentially just creating a toxic work environment for women. There were several women who were uncomfortable around him, who didn't like being left alone with him, and they told stories. And the next day when our reporting on that came out, he decided to resign. And the party right now is without a chair, and they're currently in their process right now of trying to elect a new one, which is a difficult process considering we're about to enter the 2018 election cycle. And right now the Florida Democratic Party is without a leader.
And yeah, the Florida Democratic Party President Sally Boynton Brown also quit. Why did she leave?
Correct. I think most times the chairs of any political party are going to want to have sort of their own people. She wasn't necessarily tied to some of the things we reported directly, but I think there's going to be a sense that the chairman Battelle, who resigned after our reporting, is the one who hired her. He brought her to Florida. She had been with the Idaho Democratic Party, and she was sort of seen as his top staffer and sort of his pick. So anytime a chair goes away, the next one, I think it's kind of, you know, seen as they're going to want to bring in their own people. And it was also that there was this element where she was the party's top staff member, and she was overseeing a staff that felt like, you know, there was a somewhat toxic work environment for women. So I think there was elements of that involved. But largely just I think there was a sense that whomever comes next is going to, you know, going to want to be able to put their own stamp on the party.
So what does the vacuum then mean for Florida's Democratic Party?
Well, it's a good question in the sense that it's not good for any statewide party or any organization to lose their leader, especially under sort of the cloud of allegations like this. But the Florida Democratic Party for a while has been sort of a shell of its former self. It doesn't raise a lot of money. It has struggled they've had a few very recent wins, but historically over the past two or three election cycles, they haven't done very well. So there's been sort of splinter organizations of other Democratic groups that have tried to help get Democrats elected in Florida, leaving the Florida Democratic Party a little bit weaker than it historically has been. It hasn't raised a ton of money. And so I think what it looks like moving forward will be an interesting question and how the new chair handles that, because there's, you know, now this intersection of some of these very nasty allegations about its former chair, but also these larger dynamics where the Florida Democrats, the Florida Democratic Party specifically, has been weakening over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Well, you say weakening, but I mean, some people may say it's in disarray.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good way to put it. They did down there, actually. There was just in Miami. I'm up in Tallahassee. Down in Miami, there was a special election, a state senate special election over the
District
summer
40.
That Democrats.
Yeah.
District 40. Yep, Democrat. That was a huge win for them, and that was actually sort of the biggest issue, or one of the bigger issues with them losing their chair and now having to deal with some of that fallout, is that was seen as, you know, hopefully capturing momentum for Democrats going into 2018. It was a hard fought. It was nationally watched. Joe Biden was involved. It was a big deal when they won that race. And now there's all this momentum and boom, you know, they're dealing with, you know, this sort of thing. So Democrats in Florida have raised less money. They're, you know, leaderless. They haven't, you know, had a great track record, you know, over the past few election cycles. And so I think, you know, specifically speaking to the party structure, disarray is probably a good term. But, you know, they have several candidates who want to lead the party, and we'll see what direction it goes in when that all hashes itself out next month.
So that's got to be good for the Republicans, right? I mean, they're already in control of the House and Senate and the governor's mansion, but they must be looking really good right now in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Republican Party of Florida going into 2018 is certainly sitting in a good position. There's a long, long time. So I wouldn't 2018 won't really begin in Florida until after the legislative session. In a real way, that's kind of when the campaign season kicks off. So I wouldn't put dirt on anyone's, you know, I wouldn't count the Democrats out by any means, but at this point, Republicans control all the levers of state government so they can raise a lot more money. I think most people think they have a stronger field of gubernatorial candidates, and they're sitting in a good position. So I would say that there's plenty of caveats with what I just said, but if you're talking from a broad perspective, Republicans are in a good position going into 2018.
All right. You talk about the gubernatorial race. We heard this week prominent Democratic funder John Morgan announced he's leaving his party. Didn't say anything about whether he'd run for governor. He's just leaving his party. Why?
He is fed up with, I guess, the current crop of candidates. He had a problem. I think it was unlikely he was going to run to begin with. I think there was this growing idea that he wasn't going to run. And it seemed in the statement that he put out that he was going to have a difficult time supporting any of the current gubernatorial candidates. So it his decision was made to kind of leave the party. He's a guy who agree or disagree with him, he makes bold decisions, and he saw a party in a situation he wasn't in totally happy with, and he decided to jump ship. He's still going to support some Democrats. Most prominently, he said he's still very much behind Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. So I don't know that the party, or at least specific candidates, will lose John Morgan and all of the money he brings to the table. But he is no longer, or he says he's going to leave the Democratic Party as far as being a registered Democrat and become an independent.
I'm talking with Matt Dixon of Politico Florida, and we are talking about politics for 2018. We've got a legislative session starting in January, and, of course, the elections coming up next year. Are the Democrats in disarray, or are the Republicans just ready to pounce? We'll have more on this conversation coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I'm joined by Matt Dixon of Politico Florida. He's joining us from the studios of Tallahassee, WFSU. And again, we're talking about politics. We were talking about sexual harassment claims in Florida and how that's going to impact lawmakers in Tallahassee. But we're moving now to the elections for next year and also the legislative session for next year. Matt, so we were talking about John Morgan, and he's leaving the Democratic Party, but he's putting his support behind Senator Bill Nelson. By the way, he wants Senator Nelson not to run for re-election to Senate. He wants him to do something else.
Yeah, he wants him to run for governor, and nobody had really heard that until John Morgan said it on Friday. So there's this element. The day after Thanksgiving is kind of a news hole, and John Morgan likes John Morgan's name in the headlines. So I think there was some sense that he was maybe throwing something against the wall that was going to get him a lot of attention. If Senator Nelson took the bait, so be it. But Senator Nelson's already come out and said he's running for re-election. He's not running for governor. And the idea of him not running for re-election to run for governor had never really been part of the conversation, even from a rumor mill perspective. So John Morgan is a fantastic interview, a great quote, and a big-time name in Democratic politics. But I don't think that request is going to be fulfilled.
And we still expect Governor Rick Scott to run against him.
That's the expectation. The governor hasn't done anything formal yet, but he has a political committee that has never shut down. It raises a bunch of money. It spends money on consulting and ads and polling and all of the political things you would expect someone to do, even though he's a term-limited governor. So the natural question is obviously, well, if you can't run for re-election governor, why are you spending all this political money? And most people believe the answer is U.S. Senate. So nothing formal yet, but as far as, the politicos and their expectations, most people see it to be a Nelson versus Scott, a U.S. Senate showdown.
All right. With the governor's race, I know there's a lot of time, but real quickly, let's go over the people who are running and who in this horse race is in the lead.
On the Republican side, I think most people at this point deem the front runner to be Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. Been running for a long time, raised a bunch of money. Senator Jack Latvala, who we talked about earlier, who is under investigation, is also running. But I think most people think the sexual harassment allegations will kind of derail his gubernatorial campaign. And then House Speaker Richard Corcoran. And then U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis, who represents a Northeast Florida St. Johns County district, are also kind of expected to get in, which could change the race. But right now, for the Republicans, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is probably the favorite. On the Democratic side, it's the U.S. former Representative Gwen Graham up in Tallahassee. She's running against Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. And then Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum is also in the mix, along with Winter Park, a guy named Chris King from Winter Park. And Gwen Graham right now is considered the favorite. And she's got the most amount of money. She's been doing it the longest. So I would say it's a ton of time yet. And certainly the chairs can change on the ship. But now I would say Graham and Putnam.
She has the most amount of money for the Democrats. But it's been said that Philip Levine may throw in a lot of his own money.
When I say she is the favorite, I mean at this very moment, or even perhaps before he got in, she was seen as the one who was raising the most money and doing what you need to do to become, the nominee for your party. But he's certainly a game changer. He said between $20 and $25 million of his own money he could spend. If he, does indeed follow through with that, he'll certainly be a viable candidate. So the horse race game is very difficult at this time. But to your point, Philip Levine is certainly a viable candidate.
So on the Republican side, some very prominent Senate members have been extremely vocal about their dissatisfaction with President Trump, former U.S. Representative David Jolly, party activist Rick Wilson. Is the president a problem for the party as a whole? I mean, he did win the state. Not by a lot, but he did win.
Well, it depends. It actually presents an interesting problem for Republicans because with Republican primary voters in Florida, the president still polls very well. And that you've seen a few of the candidates running. Adam Putnam is kind of seen as the poster child for this, who have historically been kind of moderate Republicans or what we would consider more establishment Republicans, who have sort of aligning themselves with the president and some of their digital advertising and some of the way they message their campaign. And that's a nod to the fact that with Republican primary voters, the president is still popular. That becomes a different question going into the general election against a Democrat. And it's sort of this interesting line that Republicans have to toe to win the primary. They sort of have to align themselves some way with the president because he's popular, but he becomes much more toxic in a general election. So that's sort of the math they're doing, the calculus they're doing right now to figure out how to toe that line.
All right. There are a number of groups nationally. They're trying to recruit less traditional candidates to run for office on all levels and from, you know, from both parties. We're talking about more women, more people of color, more young people. Is there any evidence that this is taking off in Florida as well?
Not at a huge sort of statewide U.S. Senate or gubernatorial level. A lot of those efforts, though, begin at the local level, mayors, city councils, even to a certain extent like state house. It's sort of this term in politics of building a bench where you have to develop a bench of sort of the next generation of candidates, allow them to get some political experience and sort of know what they're doing. And then when their time comes, a few election cycles from now, they'll be ready. So at the statewide, at a real big level, there isn't as much of that. But I think there's probably some of that at the more local city and county levels is parties prepare for the future.
All right. So I know we're getting ahead of ourselves. The election year, still plenty of time. But I'm wondering what are some of the issues that you think are going to be most important for voters next year?
Well, so far, it's kind of two separate issues. I mean, for what's important for voters is generally the two things that always lead is sort of the economy, jobs, and education. Those are the things that always pull highest with voters. But the things that generally get focused on, like right now, it has sort of been the president because he's a very, you know, very well known and very all encompassing. And in both parties, you know, people have very strong feelings about him. So there are these policy issues that voters say are important sometimes. But then there are how campaigns run their races. And often those are two very different things. And campaigns themselves often don't sort of touch the vegetables of politics, which is the nitty-gritty of policy, because they don't feel it, you know, gets their name out there far enough. So I think things like job, the economy, and education are going to be, again, the most important things headed into 2018. I'm not convinced we're going to get nuanced policy debates on those things, though.
Matt Dixon is with Politico Florida. We've been talking about everything Tallahassee, the election coming up next year. Legislative session starts in January. And, of course, got to see what the fallout's going to be from the sexual harassment complaints that have been coming in. Matt, it's been a pleasure, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right. Well, coming up next, we're going to talk with Carlos Alvarez, Cuban-born football player at the University of Florida who set records back in the 60s. He had a nickname. He was known as the Cuban Comet. It's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. The Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you're a young Cuban guy, I bet you might choose baseball as your sport. In the early 60s, Carlos Alvarez, a Cuban immigrant, was introduced to the American game of football at Miami's Northwest Boys Club. He fell in love with it right away. Alvarez went on to play for the University of Florida, and he became an All-American, and he still holds some of Florida's receiving records all these years later. Back then, he was dubbed the Cuban Comet, and he was recently inducted into the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce Sports Hall of Champions. We spoke to him recently from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Does your family, or I mean just in general, the you know, Cuban-American community here in South Florida even care about football? Or is this a culture still just steeped in baseball?
If they had to choose a game, it would be baseball. And, you know, when I was a little kid growing up in Cuba, my idol was Minnie Minoso. He was the Babe Ruth of Cuban baseball to me. And he had a lot of influence on me. And later on I'll tell you a little story about him, but I was so influenced by him that I know when I came in Cuba, that's all I played was baseball, a little bit of basketball. And then when I came to the States, I just started playing baseball.
Tell me about that story.
About Mini Minoso?
Yeah.
Well, you know, for Cubans, it's Mini Minoso. I still remember his number, 17. That was his number in the Cuban League. And he played mostly for the White Sox. But Mini, unfortunately, could not play baseball early on in the major leagues because they still didn't have African-American players or Latin players. So he actually came into the league a little bit late from his from when he really started playing baseball, where he could have played much earlier. And to this day, he's not in the Hall of Fame because some of his best years were missed. I'm still upset about that. But he was called the Cuban Comet in the Midwest. That's a nickname that he developed. So when I was at University of Florida, I got the nickname of the Cuban Comet, not knowing at all in any way, shape, or form that Mini Minoso was my idol, was also the Cuban Comet in the Midwest. For many years, you know, after I played, you know, people would still, you know, joke with me about the Cuban Comet. And I didn't realize that Mini was the Cuban Comet, too, until I read a story about him, that he in the Midwest area, Chicago and that area of the country, was called the Cuban Comet. So just by luck, my idol and I have the same nickname.
That is fascinating. That really is. Let's go back to your childhood, because I want to go back to when you started playing this game. As you said, you were a kid who played baseball and basketball. I think you were, what, 11 when you first played football?
You know, we went to a school. I have two brothers that are two older than me, one by 2 years and the other one by three. And I have a sister who is 5 years younger than me. My two brothers and I were always into sports in Cuba because we went to a school, La Salle, which was a private school that emphasized academics but also emphasized being outside and playing sports. We had a great baseball team in that school. So when we came to the States, my dad was absolutely convinced we would never go back to Cuba. In fact, he went to law school with Castro. And when we landed in Key West from a ferry back in the middle of 1960, I remember we landed. He looked at all of us. We had taken our car. That's about the only thing that we were able to take out. And he looked at all of us and said, "Become an American because we're never going back." And, you know, as a 10-year-old, the impact of those words really, you can't comprehend it. What do you mean you're not going back? You know, we're never going back. I just didn't realize it, but he was dead serious. And so when we ended up in Miami, we started living in North Miami. As you know, the Cuban community mostly lived in Southwest Miami, and we moved to North Miami, went to the first school, a parochial school, St. James. And we were the only kids who spoke Spanish. Everybody else, there was no Cuban kids, no other Hispanic kids. We were the only one. So we were basically thrown in the water and told to swim. And we did. It was, you know, at the time was one of the scariest things I've ever done, but it was the foresight of my parents that got us all going fairly quickly. And within the year, we had made enough friends, and some of those friends went to a boys club called the Northwest Boys Club. Nowadays, they're called Northwest Boys and Girls Club. And so we went there and started playing baseball. And then basketball season came around. We played basketball. And then football came around, and I didn't want to play football, didn't understand it or just didn't want to play it. And so because all the other kids were playing it, I decided that I would, that I'd go give it a try. Now, even putting on the equipment was a challenge. As it turned out, I did have some speed, so I was like the fastest kid in the team. They made me the quarterback. I was able to say enough English words to get everybody going to the right play. Not that you had the dolphin game plan. You had very simple plays, and I became the quarterback, and that's how I started. And it's funny because I'll never forget the first play, and we call a quarterback sweep to the right, and all of a sudden there's just like the biggest hole in the world, and I just start running, you know, and, you know, 70 yards later, I'm in the end zone, running through the end zone because I didn't even know where you stopped. So I kept on running until there was a fence, and I touched the ball to the fence. then my teammates came and grabbed me, and we were all running around being really happy. And that was my first touch in a real game of football.
And did you like the game after that?
Man, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And what was became so clear to me that I was playing football to become an American. It was the ultimate American sport. I wanted to be an American. I wanted to be accepted. And therefore, football became my way to become an American.
Your parents probably were okay with it.
You know, I had a mother who, and have a mother, she's 95 now, who always believed that her children could do anything, and would tell you that. He can do anything. And I had a dad that was very, very much about following your passion and wherever you wanted to go, so long as you did your best. That's all he wanted. And so they were very supportive.
This is the early 60s. Remind us of what life was like in Miami at that time, especially for recently arrived Cubans.
It's so, so different. It's unbelievably different. Miami was really a small town. I don't know what the population differences were, but from here, from now and then, but it was a really, really a small town. I-95 was not there. It was mostly Americans in terms of there weren't that many Cubans there. The Cubans tended to live either in Southwest Miami, you know, around the famous Calle Ocho, or in Hialeah to some extent. And the population was growing throughout the 60s as more Cubans left. But it was, you know, it was different. You know, you had to overcome certain prejudice about Cubans in Miami. Not that I experienced a lot of it. I experienced a little bit of it. And a couple of times it was very difficult. But like if you go to Miami now and your name is Carlos Alvarez, so is about another 1,000 people named Carlos Alvarez in Miami. But back then, you Carlos Alvarez stuck out. I guess that's a good way to put it. It just stuck out. And there was still some, you know, some resentment by some people in the community. I, you know, my brothers and I, we each had a Miami Herald paper route in the morning. You know, one time a lady got really upset at me because I was collecting for my brother Arturo, who had delayed collecting because so it had gotten like 3 or 4 months late. And I kind of showed up at the door at his urging to basically say, you know, please pay. And, you know, she just flat out called me a spick and to get out of there. And it just shocked me. I mean, I was stunned. You know, I remember walking out of and just couldn't believe the, you can't believe the hatred when somebody says that and means it. You know, and as a kid, you get totally confused as to, oh my goodness, you know, what is my value kind of a thing. So it was different. I mean, it's definitely different than it is now. Much more, obviously now it's much more inclusive and the differences like that are marginalized. They're not part of the fabric of Miami at all.
How did that impact your wanting to be an American? And as your father said, become an American. But then you hear something like that.
You want to become an American even more so that nobody can notice. How do you do that with a name like Carlos Alvarez? You know, it makes it a little bit difficult. But you want to make, you know, you want to lose your accent, whatever accent you have. You want it to be fairly articulate so that people can't notice that maybe Spanish was your first language. I don't know. It probably doubled down on wanting to become an American and to somehow be accepted by Americans as an American. Now, I will tell you this. I did want to become an American, and I do feel I'm an American. But at the same time, I'm very proud and feel like I'm Cuban too. And back then, I wanted to lose that Cuban identity. But when I got to be around 20 years old, 19 or so, 19, 20, I was very happy with my Cuban background and very proud of it. And at the same time, I was very proud of my being an American.
So you were surprised that universities give scholarships, and yet you had quite a few that were offering you scholarships. Is it true you had the University of Florida, but also the University of Miami offered you scholarships?
Yes. University of Miami, Florida, Vanderbilt, Georgia Tech, LSU, and I believe Georgia.
Why did you pick Florida? Why didn't you stay home?
I picked Florida for a few reasons. One, that was probably a pretty big reason. My brother Caesar was going there. But Florida had just gone through the Steve Spurrier era. He had graduated like 2 years before. I used to go to the Hurricane games in the Orange Bowl. And when Florida played, I watched Spurrier play down there, and they could pass. You know, Spurrier obviously had a passing attack, and I was pretty impressed by that because I was a running back in high school, but I was hoping to be a wide receiver in college just because of my size. So I thought overall, you know, my brothers and I are very close, that all of us being there would be a pretty cool thing. Even though really as a kid, I was always rooting for the Hurricanes. The George Myra, the Matt Stork, Kendrick, all of those guys. You know, I remember George Myra, like the just scrambling was just a show unto itself.
What was it like for you? You go up to the University of Florida, and I don't know back then how many other Cuban-born players were there, or even students.
There were no Cuban-born players. Period. No Cubans of any sort in the football team. And, you know, it was a transition. Now, I was pretty well accepted when I got up there, but it was a transition because I'm really dealing with a lot of North Florida guys. They're kind of guys that are hunters and fishermen and, you know, and I'm more of an urban guy, even though now I'm much more of an outdoors guy. But it was a transition, and they really had never dealt with a Cuban kid either. And another factor, which I think is a huge factor, is when I went to Florida, there were no African-American players. Now, the year after I was recruited, the first African-American players came to the University of Florida. Almost all of the Southeastern Conference did not have any black players. That really surprised me. And one of the things that surprised me is, like, I went to Ocala, which my roommate was from Ocala, and his dad's office had separate bathrooms for blacks and whites. And separate drinking fountains. That blew me away. I had never seen that.
We're talking with Carlos Alvarez, a Cuban-American raised in Miami in the 60s. He was known as the Cuban Comet because he played football at the University of Florida, and he set records that still hold to this day. He was recently inducted into the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce Sports Hall of Champions. He joined us from the studios at WFSU in Tallahassee. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We now return to our conversation with Carlos Alvarez. He was dubbed the Cuban Comet when he played football at the University of Florida back in the late 60s. He was a Cuban-American raised in Miami, never knew the game of football until the age of 11, and then he fell in love with it. He was recently inducted into the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce Sports Hall of Champions, and he joined us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Let's go back to that conversation.
Who called you the Cuban Comet? Who gave you that nickname?
That nickname comes from the publicity director at the University of Florida, Norm Carlson. And one day there was he was giving kind of like a press conference, and I think played a couple of games, and they said, you know, does he have a nickname or something that people call him? And, you know, my friends, you know, at Florida sometimes called me all kinds of things, like El Gato, the cat, and Chico, and, you know, really some of it was just really stupid stuff. And some reporter said, why not the Cuban Comet? And Norm Carlson said, that sounds good to me. We'll call him the Cuban Comet. The reason I know that is there's a newspaper article about it. That's the name, which is kind of interesting because, you know, back then a lot of players had nicknames. You know, people used to give more nicknames than now.
There was a game I was reading about in your college career when the Gators came to the Orange Bowl to play the Canes, and there was a lot of buzz about that game, and a lot of it's because of you. And you took the field that day in your hometown. Take us back. What was that game like?
Well, there's two games, really, that I played in the Orange Bowl when I was in the varsity, one of my sophomore year and one my senior year. And they're both pretty eventful. My sophomore year, we had only lost one game. We were coming down to play the Hurricanes. And And it was homecoming for me because by that point I had already made a couple of All-American teams that were already out. And it was a Friday night game. There was a lot of press about my coming down. And, of course, I had gotten a lot of press that year. And the Orange Bowl, the Hurricanes used to draw around, you know, 25,000, 30,000 to the Orange Bowl. And over 70,000 people showed up for that game. And a lot of them, that was the first time that a lot of Cubans, I think half of those were my family, that was the first time that a lot of Cubans saw college football or any kind of football. So that was very eventful. And nicely enough, you know, and it's really why I have such a great appreciation to the coaches I had at Florida, they knew how important that game was. And the game plan had a lot of, you know, I ended up catching 15 passes.
Which is the record, by the way. It's the record at UF.
Right, still the record at UF. And two touchdowns and about, I don't know, something like 240 yards. By the way, I had what I consider the elite quarterback of the era, a Tim Tebow-like quarterback, John Reeves, and he was absolutely on that night. Then we come back our senior year, and we're not having a very good year. Neither are the Hurricanes. But John has the opportunity to break the NCAA record on passing yards. And that's the game of the famous, and you may have heard it, called the Florida Flop. That's where towards the end of the fourth quarter, Florida, we're way ahead, and Miami is just running the ball. I mean, they're behind by 30 points or something, but they're just running the ball because the crowd has started to chant, let him score so we can get the ball back and break this record. John needed something like 10, 15 yards and to break the record, but Miami's trying to run the clock out. And so Miami was around the Florida 15-yard line, and Florida calls a timeout, and the coach at the time, who I did not necessarily get along with very much because we had a coaching change, finally said, let him score, which is really what we all wanted so that we could get the ball back. And so he sent the play in, and unfortunately it's not a play that we had practiced very much to let the other team score. I think like 9 out of the 11 players just flopped on the ground. That's how come it's called the Florida Flop. And sure enough, Miami runs a sweep and runs in, and controversy has lasted until now and will last probably the next 100 years.
The infamous Florida Flop. There it is.
We get the ball back, and I actually ended up catching the pass that broke the record for John. And then the Florida band broke into a Jesus Christ Superstar. And then the whole team, this is as the game is ending, and then the whole team jumps into the dolphin pool and just celebrates.
And you brought up the pool. People may not realize that there was a pool in the Orange Bowl with a Dolphins plate that had a dolphin in it.
Right. They brought it in for the games. The dolphin wasn't there when we jumped in on
right.
in it.
But, yeah. That would have been interesting, too.
That would have been.
You took a shot at playing professional football. I believe it was the Dallas Cowboys that picked you up in the draft. But whatever happened to your career?
So what happened was after my sophomore year, I was running track at Florida. And for some, I know the reason now, but I didn't know it back then, my knee started to swell. So anytime I ran really hard, I could do like a 2-hour workout. But then afterwards, my knee would swell. And it took 6 months to get it diagnosed. And finally, the Auburn team doctor diagnosed it as basically early arthritis based on a basketball injury I had in high school. And no way to really to operate, although they tried, which is basically kind of going to the knee, think of the end of your femur and basically scraping that so you get a scar tissue on it. And they did that operation after my junior year. But then by the end of my senior year, I needed 2 more operations because I had just really destroyed my knees. And I had no idea I was going to get drafted, but the Dallas Cowboys just took a chance and drafted me and told me and actually flew me out there and basically said, look, show us that your knee will not swell and also that you can run the 40 in the same time that you ran it when you were a sophomore. And basically the contract was unbelievable. It would be a great contract if I could show him that. And they said, we know it's going to take you a year, so go to law school because we know you're going to law school. And I was going to go to law school at Duke already. And he said, after the year, come back and let's give it a shot. And I was just thrilled. I thought, excellent. So that year, it's the hardest year I've ever worked. I worked out every single day. I studied my butt off. But I could never, at the end of the day, I could never run full speed and not have my knee swell. And without that, it would have been foolish to even try. So then I just took the other path, and the path of law.
And you're an environmental lawyer.
I'm an environmental land use lawyer. I was for many years doing litigation in that area. And now I've devoted really the last 18 years of my practice to alternative dispute resolution. And I do mediations, mostly in cases where there's a land use environmental issue. I, for example, did the when they were dredging the Port of Miami to get the bigger ships from the Panama Canal. And there was controversy about that between the city and environmental groups and the Corps of Engineers. That's the kind of mediations I do.
When you look back on your life, especially that football career, the college career, what could have been in the pros possibly, what do you think about?
Well, it's really interesting because there's always, without question, if somebody said to me, well, we'll give you five more years of knees, would you have played pros? And the answer is yes, I would have played pros. Would you have played pros knowing then what now has become evident, that there's going to be the possibility of having brain injuries and things of that sort? You know what the answer would be? As crazy as it sounds, the answer would probably be yes. I still would want to play it because I just love the game. I just love the whole thing. I just love doing. So I probably would have done that. So there's a part of me that missed not playing. At the same time, I have had such a rich life that there's no complaint whatsoever in the way my life has evolved. I'm very happy with the things that have happened, the experiences that I've had. And that's just one of those things that wasn't meant to be. But at the same time, I could have had that injury 2 years earlier, and there would be no Cuban Comet that played football. It would be only the Cuban Comet that played baseball.
And again, that is Carlos Alvarez. He was known as the Cuban Comet. He was a Cuban immigrant who was introduced to the game of football at the age of 11 at Miami's Northwest Boys Club. Fell in love with the game, went on to play at the University of Florida, became an All-American, still holds receiving records at UF to this day. Again, he was recently inducted into the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce Sports Hall of Champions. He was joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. That's all for the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.